When Al Capone fled New York City for Chicago, he'd been offered a lifeline by his friend and mentor, John Torrio, who had carved a place for himself in New York, only to give it up for his uncle in the Windy City. But Torrio knew that Chicago would be the proverbial greener pasture for him, since he was going there at the request of perhaps the most important criminal in the city during the early 1900s. James Big Jim Colosimo ruled the Chicago underworld longer than any man in the city's history. The money he raked in from the many enterprises he controlled was conservatively estimated at $50,000 a month for about 8 years, an enormous take at the time, worth almost $1.8 million today, although it would be relatively small compared to the money made by the bootleggers and racketeers of the 1920s. Colosimo was a great spender. He built a fine home for his father and an even grander home for himself, filled with an assortment of both expensive and gaudy furniture. He supported a horde of relatives, some of whom worked in his various brothels and saloons. He maintained a large staff of servants, and his two uniformed chauffeurs drove his lavish automobiles. He was rarely seen behind the wheel of any of them. He was a big man, hence the nickname, and kept his massive girth clad in linen and silk suits. He had a fixation on diamonds. He wore a diamond ring on every finger, diamond studs on his shirt front, a huge diamond horseshoe pinned to his vest, diamond cufflinks and belts and suspenders fitted with diamonds. He bought the stones from thieves and needy gamblers and hoarded them like other men collect books and paintings. He often carried loose stones in a small bag in his pocket, and when he was bored, he would pour them from hand to hand or lay them out on a black cloth to see them glisten in the light. Colosimo was a strange character and a man who helped usher in Chicago's organized crime era, although he'd never actually live to see it. Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of America. And welcome to our brand new season, Murder City. American Hauntings is written and performed by Troy Taylor, that's me, and is produced and co-hosted by Cody Beck. And this season, we're taking you to Chicago in the Roaring Twenties, an era of gangsters, jazz, flappers, bootleg booze, corrupt cops, and the ghosts those violent days left behind. We'll be telling the true story of the man who personified the era more than any other, Al Capone. A man who rose to the top spot of the criminal underworld when he was just 25 years old, ruling over a city filled with speakeasies, brothels, and gambling joints, and an army made up of assassins, gunmen, and dirty cops and city officials. But even with all his power, Capone was a man who lived in fear, haunted by a vengeful spirit that was determined to follow him to the grave. This is episode 2. Of season 10, Big Jim. Colosimo was 10 years old when his father brought him to the United States from Italy, and he spent all but two or three of his remaining 39 years in the red light vice districts of Chicago's South Side. He first worked as a newsboy in shining shoes, but quickly changed careers when he saw the money that could be made as a criminal. By the time he turned 18, he was an accomplished pickpocket and a pimp with a half dozen girls working for him. By the late 1890s, after several brushes with the law, Big Jim abandoned his life of crime, at least for a short time, to become a street sweeper, the only honest job he ever had. By 1900, he was promoted to crew foreman and organized his fellow workers into a social and athletic club that eventually became a labor union. At this point, Jim was befriended by Chicago's two most powerful political bosses, First Ward Committeeman Michael Kenna and Alderman John Coughlin. Within the First Ward lay the notorious Levee District, an era filled with whorehouses, saloons, and gambling parlors. Kenna and Coughlin employed Colosimo as their collector, overpaying him in return for the votes of all of his union members. In 1902, while working as a bagman for the ward bosses, he made the acquaintance of Victoria Maresco, an unattractive, overweight, middle-aged madam who operated a second-rate brothel on Armour Avenue. She offered Jim the position of manager, and he accepted. And 2 weeks later, they were married. Under Jim's management, the brothel prospered, and he soon acquired a brothel of his own, then another, and before long, he owned and controlled scores of them. Out of every $2 that his girls made, Colosimo kept $1.20. Like many of his competitors, he also ran several saloons near or connected by passageways to his bordellos. By 1912, he and his wife owned dozens of brothels, catering to all income levels. But one thing he discovered was that the supply of available prostitutes never met the demand. There was simply too much turnover. The average parlor house worker seldom lasted more than 5 years. She aged quickly and would sink to cheaper and cheaper houses until she hit bottom on Bedbug Row or became a streetwalker. Drink, drugs, and disease usually completed her destruction. So to replenish their stock, the vice operators turned to what was then termed white slavery. The origin of the term is usually associated with Mary Hastings, a Chicago madam of the 1890s who lured many young Midwestern girls to her brothels in Chicago's notorious Custom House Vice District. Seeking out girls between the ages of 13 and 17, she promised them jobs in the big city, and when they arrived, they were met at the local train station and taken to one of the nearby brothels, where they were locked up, stripped, and broken in by professional rapists. Mary sold the broken girls she didn't employ to other brothel keepers at prices that varied depending on the girls' ages and looks. However, one of her victims managed to scrawl on a piece of paper, "I'm being held as a slave," and tossed it out of a window. Found by a passerby and taken to the police, who raided the brothel and rescued the girl, the note supposedly inspired a newspaper reporter to coin the term white slave. Incidentally, the raid didn't cause Mary Hastings any serious damage. She operated at the same address for several more years until four of her captives escaped and finally brought about her downfall. Colosimo was deeply involved in Chicago's white slave traffic. He joined forces with other Chicago brothel owners, and they connected with other traffickers in New York, St. Louis, and Milwaukee. Over a period of nearly 10 years, they imported hundreds of girls, putting them to work in their own establishments or sending them off to other brothels. Money was starting to pour in from his illicit operations, but Colosimo considered the crowning achievement of his career to be the opening of his restaurant, Colosimo's Cafe, in 1910 on South Wabash Avenue. The club became the premier night spot in the city, and no other place could compete with its star entertainers, the beauty of its chorus girls, or the skill of its acclaimed orchestra. With musical attractions, great food, and a wide array of vintage wines, it attracted the rich and powerful from all over the city, all of whom had to brave the so-called wickedness of the Levee District to get there. Bounded north and south by 22nd and 18th Streets, and east and west by Clark and Wabash, the Levee took shape during the Columbian Exposition in 1893, when thousands of people from all over the world descended on the city. It became one of the world's best-known collections of crime and vice. Visitors to the district could partake in just about every form of sin imaginable, from alcohol to women. In addition to one run by Big Jim, two other vice rings formed the criminal organization that ruled the Levee and provided the area with its various forms of entertainment. Maurice Van Beaver and his wife Julia, who operated an interstate sex trafficking ring that extended from St. Louis to Chicago, controlled one of the Levee's vice operations. In fact, it was their business that inspired the passage of the Mann Act in 1910. Representative James Robert Mann of Illinois introduced the act that made it illegal to transport women across state lines for immoral purposes. It was believed that operators in the levee had imported more than 22,000 young women into the United States to work in their brothels. The other vice operation was managed by Charlie Maybaum, who ran a pay-by-the-hour hotel where the local streetwalkers could take their clients for a quick rendezvous. He often served as muscle and protection for other brothels that had trouble with competitors or law enforcement officials. In addition to the three major operators, there were scores of independent operators in the district. The levee featured several dollar-a-girl joints where the women provided services on a volume basis. Many of these unfortunate young ladies ended up on the levee thanks to the smooth charm of oily con men who lured them away from small-town life with promises of romance and marriage in the big city. Instead of love and excitement, they ended up robbed, beaten, and broken in, and the hellish dives of the levee. In those days, most people admitted the need for organized prostitution, but saw the methods used to induce women to become prostitutes as far more unwholesome. In Chicago, vice operators had no problem paying off police officers and politicians for permission to run houses of prostitution. However, the officials were less tolerant of what was called the procuring of the girls, although the right amount of money could always get them to look the other way. Chicago's vice trade required so many women that sex trafficking continued with or without approval, and Chicago became a supply point for other cities in the Midwest. But not all the bordellos in this part of town were cheap dives filled with so-called white slavery victims or broken-down old prostitutes. It was also the home to the Everlay Club and a number of other brothels that, while certainly not the Everlay Club, were not exactly flophouses either. The Everlay Club, run by two sisters, Ada and Minna Everlay, was perhaps the finest brothel in the United States at the time. Lavishly decorated and filled with only the finest, most beautiful, and most cultured working girls, the Everlays charged exorbitant rates and offered customers not only sex, but a complete experience with meals, music, and more. Their bordello became nationally known and attracted visitors from all over the country and even the world. There was nothing quite like the place before or since. Other higher-end brothels were operated by Vic Shaw, Zoe Millard, and Georgie Spencer, a trio of madams in constant competition with the Everlays. Shaw was a prominent red-light district fixture for almost 40 years. Even after the levee was shut down, she continued operating brothels and call-out operations until she was well into her 70s. Millard was inclined to blame anything bad that happened in the levee on the Everlays and once inflicted a terrible beating on one of her own girls for defending the sisters. Spencer, whose brothel was on South Dearborn Street in the same block as the Everlays, flaunted her operation and was eventually driven out of business by the police, who usually paid no heed to anything that was happening. Spencer was so abrasive, however, they refused to look the other way. And most likely, the Everlay sisters were probably paying them a lot more than Spencer was. Despite the efforts of those three madams, the Everlays always maintained their biggest problems came from Ed Weiss, who, with his wife, ran a brothel next door to the Everlay Club. Weiss had married a prostitute named Amy Leslie, who had once worked for the Everlays, and the pair bought the brothel next door, which had belonged to Julia Hartrout. They remodeled the place, creating sort of a scaled-down version of the Everlay Club, which irritated the sisters. The success of the place was due in some part to its luxury and the beauty of the girls Weiss hired, but most of it came from Weiss's shrewdness in putting most of the levee cab drivers on his payroll. When a drunken spender got into a cab and asked to be driven to the famous Everlay Club, he would be taken to Weiss's place instead, and most of them never knew the difference. The brothel on the other side of the Everlay Club was called the Sappho, and it was owned and operated by Weiss's brother, Louis. It was also a better class of resort, but it was never as popular as Ed's. There were also several other cheap brothels, like the Casino, which was run by Vic Shaw's husband, Roy Jones, the Old 92, French Charlie's, and the California, which was run by Blubber Bob Gray and his wife, Teresa McCaffrey. The California was one of the toughest parlor houses in the district. Around 30 to 40 girls worked the place at one time, wearing shoes, flimsy nightgowns, and nothing else. They often stood naked in the windows and doorways whenever a policeman wasn't in sight, and two men worked the sidewalk outside, inviting in those who passed by, and of course, who had taken a look. When customers appeared, the girls were brought into a large room that was empty, except for a couple of benches along one wall. The girls were paraded in, and the customers were allowed to choose. The going rate for a tumble was $1, but 50 cents would do if the man turned out his pockets and proved he didn't have a dollar to his name. The California remained one of the seediest dives in the district until 1909, when it was raided by federal immigration agents searching for foreign women who had been brought to the United States for immoral purposes. They found six, quote, white slaves at the California. Blubber Bob, who weighed over 300 pounds, tried to escape when the authorities burst in, but he got stuck in a window, and it took three men to pull him out. There were several other celebrated houses in the levee during its heyday, including that of Frankie Wright, who called her brothel the library. It was named for the single case of well-worn books that graced its parlor. It also offered a great name for someone who told his wife he was simply going to the library. Big Jim Colosimo owned two large brothels in the district, the Victoria and the Saratoga. The Victoria was named in honor of his wife, which I guess we could say is romantic, if that's your thing. At one end of the district was a notorious saloon called the Bucket of Blood, which stood across the street from Bedbug Row. Nearby was a brothel called Black Maze, which offered light-skinned African-American girls for white customers and allegedly presented, quote, animal acts for those with a taste for such things. There was also the acclaimed House of All Nations, which allegedly had prostitutes from foreign countries, although most were just Chicago prostitutes who used phony accents. The place had two entrances. One door had an entry price of $5, and the other door cost $2 to enter. Not surprisingly, the same girls worked both sides of the house. The levee was a wide-open place for years, under the protection of its vice leaders, well-paid Chicago cops, and corrupt politicians, who ensured the necessary money was in the right hands. Reformers, especially religious ones, constantly hampered operations in the levee. And eventually, the crusade and the propaganda against what they called white slavery would get the better of the district and close it down once and for all. But Big Jim didn't spend much of his time at the establishments that made him the most money. His cafe had become the heart and soul of the district. It was a place of gaudy opulence, from its gilded doorways to the massive mahogany and glass bar. Green velvet covered the walls, and gold and crystal chandeliers hung from sky blue ceilings where angels cavorted on cotton white clouds. The restaurant was a dazzling dreamscape of gold mirrors, tapestries, and murals of tropical vistas. With the flick of a switch, hydraulic lifts raised and lowered the dance floor. Festivities seldom got underway before midnight and often continued until well past dawn. Gamblers could find any game they fancied, from faro to roulette and high-stakes poker, in a suite of rooms on the second floor. Colosimo's Cafe enjoyed national renown, and it was a place where local dignitaries and businessmen might rub elbows with killers and thieves. It catered to visiting celebrities like Al Jolson, George M. Cohen, John Barrymore, and Sophie Tucker, whose racy songs had caused the normally permissive Chicago police to place her under arrest for indecency on several occasions. Colosimo loved the opera, and no matter how packed the place was, he could always find a seat for a performer or guest from the Chicago Civic Opera Company. He considered famous singer Enrico Caruso a close personal friend. But as profitable as Colosimo's was, it was produced only a fraction of the fortune that allowed Big Jim to maintain two limousines and homes for his father, himself, his wife, and a mistress. The chief sources of his annual income were, of course, his chain of brothels. Vice had earned Big Jim a vast fortune, which in turn made him one of Chicago's wealthiest Italian immigrants. And thanks to this, he found himself a target for the notorious Black Hand. The Black Hand first emerged as an organized crime entity around 1900. Because of the isolation caused by their lack of language skills, Italian immigrants were often easy prey for criminals within their own ranks. Suspicious of authority, they were at the mercy of groups like the Black Hand, a shadowy society that terrorized poor, working class, and eventually prosperous Italians. The thing was, the organization wasn't really all that organized. It was simply a collection of criminals that were separately extorting Italian Americans. It was newspaper reporters who gave the extortion rings a singular name, calling it the Black Hand. As word of it spread, though, the notion of it inspired real terror. The way the Black Hand operated was both simple and direct. First, a victim who showed signs of prosperity would be chosen from among the Italian immigrant population. For instance, if a man purchased any property and that fact became public knowledge, he could almost count on the attention of the Black Hand. A letter bearing the signature of the Black Hand was then sent to the victim demanding money. If the letter was ignored or the victim refused to pay, his home, office, or business would be bombed. If he still refused to pay, he'd be murdered. Most of the letters were blunt instructions about sums of money and where that money was to be delivered. Other letters were cleverer, or often worded with politeness and Italian courtesy. No matter how they were phrased, though, each brought the promise of death if the instructions were not carried out to the letter. Hundreds of these letters were sent and received, followed by payoffs or murders between 1900 and 1920. Despite what seemed like a massive operation, none of the extensive investigations conducted by the police ever revealed a Black Hand organization that reached national or even citywide proportions. As I mentioned, the Black Hand was not an actual group. It was a method of crime. It was used by individuals, small groups, and large organized gangs. In Italy and Sicily, it was employed by the mafia, and after it gained the name Black Hand in America, the extortionists began adding the image of a Black Hand to their letters. They also liked to use drawings of skulls and crossbones, daggers, and crosses for dramatic effect. During the first two decades of the 20th century, there were said to have been 400 murders connected to the Black Hand, and that was just in Chicago. They preyed on Italian and Sicilian immigrants, and one of the leading enforcers was rumored to be a killer with the moniker of the Shotgun Man, who was said to be responsible for at least 38 killings between January 1910 and March 1911. The Chicago police faced impossible obstacles as they tried to combat the Black Hand. Hundreds of arrests were made, but suspects were usually released within hours because no evidence connecting them with specific crimes could be found. Many cases of murder and extortion were brought into the courts, but convictions were impossible. And those few who were sent to prison were usually quickly paroled thanks to payoffs to corrupt politicians. The reason it was so hard to prosecute the Black Hand gang members was the same reason they were so terrifying in the first place. As soon as a Black Hand suspect was arrested, witnesses and members of the victim's family were threatened with death if they gave information to the police. Judges, jurors, and members of the prosecution staff, even their families, received threats. In one case, a witness was about to give details of a Black Hand extortion plot when a man entered the courtroom and just simply waved a red handkerchief at him. The witness froze and refused to speak anymore. The state was then forced to abandon the case. By the late 1910s, police officials were forced to try and downplay the Black Hand. They simply had no way of controlling the situation and no way to combat the threats or apprehend the killers of those who failed to pay. Most Chicago cops just denied their existence altogether. as the FBI would do years later when forced to confront the reality of the mafia. The failures of those in city government who dismissed the Black Hand added to the helplessness and despair being experienced by Italian immigrants, who were already dealing with the hardships of life in a new and unpredictable country, and now were being terrorized too. Left to deal with the extortion on their own, a handful of Italian businessmen decided to take matters into their own hands. They formed what was called the White Hand Society, an organization that was sponsored by wealthy businessmen, the Italian Chamber of Commerce, Italian newspapers, and several fraternal orders of Italians and Sicilians. It was formed to work with the police and try and exterminate the Black Hand. Although virtually every member of the society was threatened with death at one time or another, it remained active for several years. Private detectives were employed to help the police investigate Black Hand cases, and agents were even sent to Italy and Sicily to look into the histories of the most notorious gangsters. They also arranged for the protection of witnesses and their family members. Several murderers and extortionists were sent to prison through the efforts of the White Hand, but they were soon paroled and resumed their activities. This made the Society of Neighborhood Vigilantes more of a symbolic gesture than anything else. Their intentions were good, but they were against a much too powerful adversary, and the White Hand faded out of existence around 1912. The Black Hand gangs endured for another 8 years until a federal law finally forced them out of existence. Once the government began prosecuting extortion as the misuse of the United States mail, dozens of Black Hand gangsters began to be convicted, fined, and sent to federal prisons. Politicians, corrupt or not, couldn't help them, and most convicted men served their full sentences. The Black Hand soon disappeared, but not because they were afraid of federal agents and postal inspectors. By 1920, and the coming of Prohibition, the extortion gangs found that bootlegging and rum running was a more profitable field for their talents. But in 1909, during the thick of the Black Hand letters, bombings, and murders in Chicago, Big Jim received his first Black Hand extortion letter. He knew what to expect, and he initially went along with it. He met demands for as much as $5,000, but as the extortionists continued to bother him, demanding more and more money each time, he decided to fight back. He provided work for plenty of tough gunmen, and the next time he received a letter, Jim wrapped up a bundle of plain paper, armed himself with a revolver, and accompanied by an assortment of muscle with sawed-off shotguns, he showed up for a rendezvous under a Southside bridge ahead of the scheduled time. After dropping off the bundle as directed, Big Jim and his men hid in the shadows across the street. At midnight, three men approached the bundle. Before they could examine it, the blast of several shotguns rang out, and the three Black Hand men all fell dead on the street. Jim enjoyed some peace after that, but it didn't last long. He soon received a demand for more money from yet another Black Hand gang. Dealing with extortionists wasn't his specialty. He needed someone to work with him in Chicago who was smarter and more ruthless than he was. Victoria convinced her husband to call her nephew in New York, an up-and-coming gangster named John Torrio. John quickly took charge of the situation. Within days of his arrival, three Black Hand extortionists were slaughtered under the Rock Island Railroad overpass on Archer Avenue. John, with his personal aversion to bloodshed, had arranged the massacre. Other killings followed, and finally, Big Jim was free of his tormentors. But Torrio's service to Colosimo went far beyond planning the murders of Black Hand criminals. He traveled back and forth between New York and Chicago for a time before finally settling in the Windy City. Torrio was an organizational genius. Years later, Elmer R. Irie, chief of the enforcement branch of the U.S. Treasury Department, called him, quote, the father of modern American gangsterdom. This was no exaggeration, for within months, the cool, soft-spoken man had consolidated Big Jim's holdings and turned him into the foremost Chicago racketeer of his era. Starting with the Saratoga brothel, of which his grateful uncle made him the manager, Torrio began supervising his brothels and got them on sound financial footing. He next organized the saloons and the gambling dens. He turned the Colosimo Van Beaver sex trafficking ring into the dominant force in the levee and personally saw to the bribing of police and public officials. On behalf of Big Jim, Torrio branched out into the protection racket and collected payments using no other persuasion than a quiet word of warning, a thin smile, and an ice-cold stare. He suffered a slight setback when he was arrested, along with other members of the organization, after transporting a dozen girls from St. Louis to Chicago. Maurice and Julia Van Beaver paid a $1,000 fine and went to jail for a year. Five others received lesser sentences, including the prosecution's main witness, a pimp who had delivered the St. Louis merchandise. Torrio, however, was freed because the pimp wouldn't testify against him. Colosimo, shielded by his political connections, wasn't even questioned in the case. But the days were numbered for the vice districts in Chicago. They would soon fall on hard times and would be shut down by reformers and public pressure. John Torrio, though, saw the future coming long before anyone else did. Prohibition was on the horizon, and he knew there were millions to be made in the illegal liquor business. But to start making that money, he was going to have to convince his uncle to expand his operation. He knew he might need some help from someone he trusted to persuade Big Jim to go along with his plans. So John placed a call back to New York to a young and eager man that he'd known since he was a boy. And Al Capone was soon on his way to Chicago. Thanks again for listening to American Hauntings, and we hope you'll stay tuned for the postmortem section of the episode. It's coming up right after these messages from our sponsors.
We all are buying supplements, taking vitamins, and following the latest workout trends. But what if the newest tip from your favorite health influencer isn't actually what your body needs? True Diagnostic helps you find out the exact supplements and lifestyle changes that can make a difference and which ones might just be wasting your money. If you're spending money on supplements, workouts, and wellness trends, it's worth knowing what is actually moving the needle for you. That's where True Diagnostic comes in. My at-home test was simple. The instructions were clear and easy to follow, and it came with a prepaid envelope, which made it convenient to send back because I don't have any stamps. I'm super stoked to receive my results in the next 2 to 4 weeks so I can dial in exactly what needs to be changed to improve longevity and health markers. Because I have plans for this podcast, so I gotta be in tip-top shape, and True Diagnostic is helping me get started. One of the tests True Diagnostic offers that I've taken is called True Health, which measures your current health. It tests over 105 biomarkers, including vitamins, minerals, antioxidants, and fatty acids to understand systems' health right now. It focuses on energy, metabolism, inflammation, and nutrient status today. And it provides your top three health actions for the next 90 days. You can get even more info if you opt in for the combo kit, which includes the True Health test and the True Age test, which reports on longevity and aging. The experience and process is so simple that even Troy and I were able to figure it out. You order online and the kit ships right to your door. It's a quick single finger prick at home, then you drop it in the prepaid return package. You can get digital results with an easy to follow 90-day plan in your inbox. Your only job, follow the three most important actions you can take for 90 days, then retest to see your progress. You can get a one-time kit just to get a baseline of where your body's at currently, or a subscription to measure progress over time. Also, True Diagnostic is trusted by top longevity clinics and health professionals, not just consumers at home. Right now, our listeners can get 20% off at TrueDiagnostic.com using code HAUNTINGS at checkout. That's TrueDiagnostic.com and use code HAUNTINGS for 20% off today. Choose True Age, True Health, or the Combo Kit as a one-time purchase or subscription. Oh, yeah, probably. Yeah, there's a lot of things going on.
Okay, let's go. Ready for a little more American Hauntings this week? Well, we're back with the postmortem, the part of the show after the show where we sharpen our knives and dissect the episode. My name is Troy Taylor. I'm the guy who narrates and writes the show. And across from me is the guy who is my friend, co-host, and partner in crime, Cody the Hammer Beck.
I'm just going to keep trying the nicknames until I find one that sticks.
I did glance over that a little bit when I first
saw it. Yeah, I'm not sure where that one came from. Just kind of liked it. So,
well, because I mean, I appreciate
you. Well, the no sounded mean.
But I love
that. I know a lot of gangster. I know a lot of gangster nicknames were kind of mean, you know, but a lot of them based on guys' weights and things.
Blubber Bob.
Yeah, the nose seemed mean.
No, I think that's honestly the funniest one you could do, and and the first thing. But I appreciate that. But it is the nose.
All right. Well, maybe I'll just stick with that one.
We went through all that, but no, we could try. We could test some out. I'm always curious with nicknames too. It's like, usually you have to be given one, and then how long do you get to wear it before you know feel like if it sticks or not? Or I guess it's kind of other people that maybe decide if it's gonna stick or not.
Well, and as we'll find out later on in the season, the nicknames weren't usually. They didn't usually. It wasn't like Tony Soprano sitting around coming up with nicknames. Right. It was usually like the cops or more importantly, the newspapers up the nicknames because it made for a good story.
Of course, that is
Tony Big Tuna Accardo, you know, and they, you know, and Paul the Waiter Rica, you know, things like that. I mean, you kind of like, okay, I'm not sure where that came from, but. Right. Sure, why not?
And I am really excited to talk about the little Blubber Bob incident later, but I have thoughts on that. But we were just talking, Troy. We've seen each other a few times this week.
Three times in the last week and a half. Yeah. So, and one of those times was at Dead of Winter. Mm-hmm. And I think we both would like to say, you know, I know we said it when people listened to the live episode last week, but thanks again to everyone. Who came to Dead of Winter and made it another big success for people to, you know, we get some stuff with the food banks around here. Mm-hmm. And we ended up with a lot of stuff again, as we always have in the past. And we just wanted to say we really appreciated it. And I think that Franklin Lodge was a really good location for what we were doing. I mean, I know it was a lot of stairs and things, but, you know, it's an old building and it's just, I don't know. It was a cool spot. And I really enjoyed it. And I think a lot of other people did too.
It was cool. So, like I said, my first time really in that building, mm-hmm. growing up, you know, real close to it all those years, but it was my first time in there. Super creepy when I was there Friday night in the dark, going up and down those stairs, but didn't feel evil or anything. It was nice.
No, nothing like
that. I enjoyed it.
It was a little unnerving. It can be a, you know, as if, you know, they're not a creepy enough place as it is, these big, you know, lodges with all the miscellaneous hidden rooms everywhere and stuff. It's creepy enough as it is, but man, wandering around in the dark makes it even creepier. So,
yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So also to kind of catch people up on what's happening, Haunted America tickets on sale. Had a lot of people who responded to my pressure.
Yes,
at a winner by getting signed up for the conference. So we have lots of general admission tickets this year. Obviously, it's a big venue, but the tours, the ghost hunts, the workshops, the special events are really filling up fast. Actually, this past week, I had several of them. I had to finally, Marcus sold out. So we've got others that are getting close to being full. So if you are hoping to take part in other parts of the conference, you really don't want to wait any longer. Yeah. You know, if you're just coming to just come to the event, you know, you've got some time, you got a little time,
sure.
But if you want to take part in anything else that's going on, really you got to get on it. So, also we have, March 7th coming up. We've got this will be at the American Oddities Museum, be our second anniversary. Not at this location, it'll be like our second month, month or something, but our second location for the museum. And this is a great chance to come see the new space, check out the new exhibits and displays. We got a much bigger bookstore and gift shop now. I'm going to be there all day that day signing books. Plus, the first 100 people who come that day will get a free American Oddities Museum pint glass because you can, you know, raise a glass to the museum if you'd like. But they are pretty cool. I posted a picture up of them recently and people are like, well, I can't be there, but I want one. Well, we should have some left over.
Hopefully.
So you can come buy one sometime. But anyway, we also have dinner events and dinner tours at or leaving from the museum in February and March. At the end of the month, I'm doing a Limp Family event on February 28th. March 7th, of course, is the evening with H.H. Holmes. I'll be hosting that in the evening after the daytime event. It is a ticketed event. But you know, people are going to be coming. I've had a lot of people tell me, oh, I'm coming that night. I want to see that. So I'll just come early. So that mm-hmm. should work out great for anybody who wants to see the evening with H.H. Holmes, in addition to celebrating the museum with us. But then mm-hmm. the week before that, I've got a dinner with the Limp family. Week after that, on Friday the 13th, I'm doing one of the In a Dark Place Sinister Hauntings dinners. March 14th, March 27th. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry, man.
Another Friday the 13th, 2 months
yeah,
in a row?
Yeah, we have two in a row. Well, once February, March always lay out the same way.
Uh-huh.
So if you get a Friday the 13th in February, you get one in March too. So
I just never pay attention.
We did a Great River Hauntings tour this month. And then next month, I'm flipping it around to do a Ghost of the River Road.
Love it.
So yeah, that'll be fun. Or we're doing the dinner event, then Ghost of the River Road the next night. So. And then I do have the River Road on the 14th and the 27th, and then the 21st, Abraham Lincoln dinner. You just asked me about that the other mm-hmm. day. And then at the end of March on the 28th, I'm doing American Murder Houses, which is kind of harkens back to our theme from a couple of seasons ago. So mm-hmm. some of those places may make an appearance. And then there will be some other ones that we did not cover. So that should
nice.
Be fun. So anyway, guys, check that out. There's a lot more. You can see it all on the website at dinnerandspirits.com. So check that out.
Gotcha. So anytime we have the perfect February where it's the first is a Sunday and then the 28th is a Saturday, we're going to have that Friday the 13th.
Yeah, I think so.
And then March is the same until the 31st, kind of messes
right,
up.
Right, right, right. Yeah, a couple extra days in March.
Yes, I love it. But Troy, one of the other times we saw each other, though, is we attended your Valentine's Day event.
Yes.
That was really nice. It was fun. If it wouldn't have been rude, I would have just been eating pork steaks the entire time.
I know. Throughout. That was the first time the caterer had brought pork steaks. And for those of you who are listening outside of the St. Louis area, you're thinking, really? But if you're from the St. Louis area, you know pork steaks are a local delicacy.
Yes, a good one.
I don't know what it is. We all love them. It is a St. Louis area thing. And man, I always have a package of them in the freezer.
Yes.
I can't wait till I get a chance to get out on the grill so I can throw a big thing of pork steaks on it. It's crazy.
And so
yeah, that was the first night they'd had them, and that was amazing.
Well, I was like, we were talking about what we're gonna get or eat on the way there. And I was saying, this is probably what it's gonna be. I've seen the spread a couple times and then I'm going
yeah, it's
down
always
the
a
line.
Surprise, but yeah.
Yeah, and I've seen the spread, but I kind of knew some of the heavy hitters, and so I'm going down the line and I was like, oh my God. I was like, there's pork steaks here.
Yeah.
And so I grabbed just the biggest one I could find, but only one.
But if you'd have said something we had left over, you'd have taken some home.
It's
man,
fine. So. It's fine. But it put me in the mood for spring and for summer and barbecue,
yeah.
Absolutely. And
absolutely.
So I'm really excited about that. Well, hey, I wanted to give a quick shout out to our latest subscribers on Patreon. So thank you very much for supporting the show to Jason, Ian, Messina, Stephanie, Jamie, and Claire. So I really hope you're enjoying all the extra content that we have on the Patreon shows. And I hope Troy's not grossing you out too much, depending on where you are and what series you're on.
On this one, we're probably okay on the latest one. But we do have five seasons of an alternate podcast that you can binge only through Patreon. We are in our sixth season now about the Starved Rock murders of 1960. We are nearing the end. We're not there yet, but we're getting closer. We're closer to the end than we are the beginning. Let's put it that way. And things are just about to get super controversial. So I'll be interested to get some feedback on that as things go. And I will tell you that we do have some previous seasons that are not for the faint of heart. Let's just leave it at that. There's some tough seasons in the past, but anyway, we do offer that show every other week. It's every other Tuesday, and you can get it along with special discounts and shirts and advanced sales and other things too as a Patreon supporter. And it really helps us out as well. And you can check out our Patreon program at patreon.com/ American Hauntings.
Yes, and everybody is caught up with shirts. I've been getting emails saying like, hey, thanks, we've got, you know, this one and that one. And I actually, just because of some complications over the, you know, past months, I just started launching shirts at people that have been subscribers.
Sure.
So I was just sending them out.
Nah, it works. So,
and
we have Cody has all of the American Hauntings designs, podcast designs and stuff for American Hauntings. If you go to the American Oddities Museum page, we also have some American Oddities Museum's shirts that you can get online. You don't have to always be in the store to get them. We do have some designs that we don't even have in the store that are posted up there. And I even put up one American Nightmares podcast shirt.
Oh, nice.
In the store. So, I mean, I may do some more of those, but this one was just kind of fun. So,
no, I love it. Yeah. So we got, basically we got merch, we got events, we got books, we got stuff. We got stuff everywhere, all over.
Yeah, pretty much. Basically. Pretty much. Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, hey, I wanted to give a quick shout out to this listener. We got a listener review, and this one comes to us from Adabunny, and it is titled History and Hauntings. And I believe there's some sword and a shield and a coffin emoji in there. That it just says, I love this. Listen, is so well researched and presented in an original, brilliant style, stellar. And then a star emoji. Nice. So short, sweet, to the point.
Yeah.
Nice emoji use. And thank you for leaving us a review. It really helps the show.
Yeah, helps people to find the show. And if we do read your review during this part of the show, we'll send you some cool stuff in the mail. So if you hear your review, text me your address on the haunt line at 217-791-7859, and I will make sure that you get some cool free stuff in the mail. And I swear to God, the last couple of people, that it is coming. Everyone has been super patient, but I've been gone a lot. And, you know, we've either had events going on or I've been traveling, and I'm leaving again tomorrow. The day that you hear the show, I will be in the air again to do a different show in LA this time. No, I can't talk about it yet, but eventually I will. So I hopefully people watch the werewolf show that that was fun. It was fun to watch it. It actually turned out pretty good. I mean, there were a couple of cheesy spots, but that, I mean, that's standard, you know,
just TV
documentary style TV, you know. But
yeah,
it is fun. And Lawrence Fishburne is so cool. It's so great to hang out with him. Went out to okay, that's all a lie.
I was just gonna say,
never met, you know, I did not meet him. The crew hadn't met him. I think he just comes in like once a month and does whatever he needs to do for like the entire season of episodes. But no, people always ask me, and I'm like,
well, I was hoping that something had changed, because I was like, but
it's like the Dan Aykroyd one. And no, I haven't met him either. So.
I think you're the one that pointed this out to me when I was talking about some show that I've been watching with Donnie Wahlberg. And I was like, it's just one after another of him turning a corner in a warehouse with his hands in his pockets. And you're like, yeah, because they do it all in like one day, and like just change some outfits maybe every now and then. Or like,
Or it's probably just in front of a green screen.
And they just
put in a background. I mean, that's been the way they've done stuff since. I mean, gosh, I started doing TV stuff years and years ago, and then we were doing that then. And it's now everyone I do, I'm sitting in front of a green screen.
So you can never
wear anything green, or your body disappears.
It makes way more sense too, because like the way that the lighting and everything is with that spooky warehouse, like it's probably way easier just like put it in a post.
Absolutely, because otherwise it would take hours to get it lighted the way they want, and then he wouldn't be able to walk around or anything.
Sure.
So I'm sure that's what's going on.
Oh man. Well, yeah. Well, check out Troy and all these things. So basically, everybody, thanks for hanging with us. We got a lot of stuff going on all over the place, and but hey, today we're here to bring you the next chapter in this really fun series. Are you ready to dive in?
Sure. Yeah. No, I'm ready. And I'm gonna start this off. Usually you do, but let me start off.
Yeah, please.
And I'm gonna say the same thing that I said to you the other night when I saw you, is that I know that the podcast isn't called Al Capone, and I know that, I mean, he is the main character, but, and I know that in this episode, he's not in it at all, but all of this stuff is laying the groundwork. Mm-hmm. Before long, it'll be, you know, a lot more, but we have to we have to lay the groundwork for the reason that he is in Chicago in the first place.
Yes.
Because he didn't start out there and probably never would have come there if it wasn't for, you know, a buddy who went there first and then said, hey, I need a reliable right hand and called Capone. So, yeah, but we will. And we have to get to a little bit more of that next time. But things are, the action's going to start amping up here pretty quick.
Sure.
So,
anyway, well, I'm liking
thank you for hanging in there. I know you're digging it and I hope other people are too.
Yeah.
It's just, it's a lot of stuff that I, you know, needed to lay the groundwork for. And, you know, don't get me wrong, I went off at a tangent a bit about the vice districts, but this stuff was so interesting.
Yes.
The way things used to be, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, not necessarily, not good things, but you can see where a lot of things, especially in the news these days, how a lot of things have not changed that much as far as this sort of entertainment, I guess you would call it. I don't think that's the right word, but how that happened then and continues to happen now.
Well, there's so many common threads. There's going to be that. There's going to be business feuds and competition just with different businesses, but that didn't really change. Basic supply and demand, basic kind of seeing writing on the wall of where the future of commerce is going. I mean, it's all principles that remain the same today, just the things around them change.
Right.
You know, and we're going to talk about a lot of those. I think people are going to like these episodes because I myself loved learning about some of these heavy hitters that brought up Capone or, you know, set the stage
and maybe aren't, you know, household names, you know? So
yes.
So, all right. I'll turn it over to you and let you steer things here. Whatever you want to talk about.
One of them we're going to talk about first is Big Jim. Big Jim. No, James Colosimo. Is that right? Yes.
Colosimo. Colosimo. He
rules Chicago. The man loves diamonds, as you mentioned. Yeah. And you had said, quote, hoarded them like other men collect books. And at first I took this as I was personally offended. And then I realized who was saying it to me.
Yeah, right.
Because you're the only
me.
You're the only person I think I know personally that has more books than I do. And you have a lot more books than I do.
But I was over here at my house the other day and he went, every place you live, you have books in every fucking room. I
remember I was walking to your restroom and there's a little corridor thing there and that was just filled with books too.
Yep.
Like, you gotta get them in
anywhere I can make them fit.
Yes. Something I thought was interesting about Big Jim is, and something we don't often get to talk about, I think probably because we either don't know about it or it's just not as glamorous, but you mentioned how he eventually left his life of crime, became a street sweeper. And I think a lot of times we don't get to talk about somebody trying to make good or trying to get out of the life for a little bit, you know?
Well, and he didn't stay out because he turned it into a labor union, which he then turned into a racket. So, you know, even after trying to temporarily go straight, it was only because he was young.
Of course.
You know, he hadn't quite learned the way that he could, you know, rake in millions, literally millions.
You know? Can you tell me a little bit more? We've talked about it before. I know that it's very important, but can you tell me a little bit about the importance of labor unions in cities and in organized crime and how those things tend to sometimes get tied together
we'll talk about it more as things go on, because, you know, even early on, a lot of the gangsters found ways into labor unions because of all the dues that were being paid in by members and things. And so it's always about money one way or another. And later on, it will become really important to the gangster economy, because as prohibition starts to wane, these guys start looking for new ways to make money and protection rackets and things like that. And, you know, labor unions became really important. I mean, you know, we got into some of that, I think, when we did our Jimmy Hoffa episode, and how deep the gangsters and organized crime get into labor unions. You know, a lot of that has been, I don't know that it's completely been erased, but a lot of it has in more recent years, mostly because I find that unfortunately the labor unions have sort of waned in popularity. I mean, there aren't nearly as many as there used to be. But then you will hear about, you know, say Starbucks unionizing and things. And it's gotten to the point where some of these companies are so powerful now that they can shut down unions.
Oh, yeah.
That they couldn't before. I mean, WRN, they always wanted to.
Right.
Nobody, right. No, there are very few businesses that wanted a labor union because, you know, they came in setting rules. And mm-hmm. by organizing and working together, they were able to start, you know, the 8-hour work day and, you know, the 5-day work week and things that didn't exist, you know, pre 1920, really.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, you work every day, you work whatever shifts they tell you to work, you know, kids worked and children laboring in factories and things. And, you know, it was labor unions that changed all that stuff, but then it would also be something that would make them a target to gangsters and organized crime.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. All right. No, interesting. And then yes, you did go into a lot of detail about the vices and the brothels and that.
Well, Chicago was, I mean, believe me, this scratches the surface. I've written an entire book on nothing but the vice districts in Chicago.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so much and it could really very easily turn into a whole thing. I mean, you could do probably a 10 episode podcast on nothing but vice in Chicago. I mean, easily,
yeah.
Very easily.
Wow.
Who knows? Maybe one of these days I will. But I just
do that as a Patreon because this stuff got very upsetting very quickly.
Yeah, well, this scratches the surface and it's a lot worse than this.
Yeah.
There were a lot of things that were much worse that I didn't even get into. I mostly just tried to keep it about the Southside Levee, just mostly because that's where Jim had his operations and where the Everly sisters were and things. You know, that story is kind of falls differently. Obviously, mm-hmm. you may have noticed the way that I covered the Everly sisters as opposed to some of these other people. I think maybe the main reason for that is that their story mm-hmm. is really interesting on its own. Separately from all of this, really. But they also ran a different kind of operation. Mm-hmm. I mean, they weren't, you know, it wasn't white slavery girls. I mean, there were people who were trying to work there.
Sure.
Because of the pay and because of the way they were treated. Mm-hmm. You know, much better than you would find anywhere else in Chicago or probably anywhere in the country. Because the Everly Club became one of the most famous brothels in the entire country at a time when it was legally or mostly legally allowed.
Right.
I mean, there were stipulations. There were things that happened that would cause a police raid or something. But in a lot of cases, you know, the vice districts were there for a reason. They were put there, you know, it's kind of like we talked about Storyville in New mm-hmm. Orleans.
What yeah.
we did that season. I mean, that was done on purpose to segregate vice.
Right.
People would, you know, they accepted the fact that organized vice needed to exist. I think I said this in the story, but they didn't like the way that most of these places were procuring their workers.
Right.
And that's where, you know, Jim was involved in, you know, sex trafficking, heavily involved. He was one of the top people in the area. So this is not a good guy. And I'm not painting him as a good guy. I'm painting him as this is a story about this guy. And, you know, none of these guys were. I mean, you know, Capone, Torrio, all those guys, you know, their businesses thrived on brothels and prostitution. And most of those women were not there by choice.
Yeah.
You know, it's one thing when someone is there by choice, that it's their body autonomy. But in cases like that, that wasn't what was going on. And we'll get into that more. But that was one of the main kind of problems that were between Capone's group and the Northside mob. Is those guys didn't go for prostitution. They stayed out of that completely. Alcohol was one thing. Prostitution was something completely different. Mm-hmm. And that will become a point of contention.
Contention, yeah.
Yeah.
So, I think that makes a lot of sense. And before you even got to the point in the monologue about them not really minding about vice, but it was more about how they ended up getting their workers and stuff, I was talking out loud and I was thinking on the same page. I was like, yeah, I don't really give a shit about, you know, people want to sell some drugs. They want to do something a little
legal. Problem.
Fine. But then it does seem to, it crosses the line when it's trafficking people and human rights, sort of things like that.
Right.
And it kind of seems the same way with the cops. They're like, yeah, you guys are going to do shitty things. But if you start doing, if you take this step,
cross this line. Yeah. Then that's too far.
Yeah. And so that makes sense. I don't know why exactly, but that makes sense. And I guess
human rights thing. These operations, no matter what, were all bought and paid for.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's the corruption was, you know, and had been for a very long time. Corruption,
yes,
you know, ran rampant in Chicago and will continue to do so for quite some time. And that's going to be something that's going to be constantly brought back up as we go, because there's a reason that everybody operated as freely as they did and made so much money is they were putting the right money in the right hands.
Right. Exactly. Right. Yep. Yeah, runs the
so
world.
There were no good guys
when
to vice operations in Chicago. They're just
yes.
one in.
So don't come at us saying we're supporting this person.
No, they're not. Absolutely not. Yeah.
I do want to talk about the Everly Club, but mostly the scaled down version right next door. Sappho. Is that
Sappho.
Sappho. I love paying the cab drivers. So smart. Like that's a
beautiful... And most people probably wouldn't, you know, they didn't know the difference. They only knew they were going to the right general place. And then, you know, which I'm sure drove the sisters crazy.
Yes. So, I just thought it was a brilliant, terrible tactic, but I thought it was very, very smart. But this is when I wrote down, it sounds like there's still just a lot of typical business feuds and competition and cutthroat industries.
Sure.
The industries have just changed, I guess.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
But the same kind of stuff has been happening for a long time. And this is where you mentioned Blubber Bob gets stuck in a window like Winnie the Pooh is basically what I'm thinking.
I know, right?
Just and I imagine it's just his ass is hanging out and they got to like grease him up, pull him through the window one way or another.
Yeah.
And they said he was over 300 pounds. That doesn't seem like a guy would be worthy of the nickname Blubber Bob, but I guess.
Well, I think, you know, height wise, I think is
okay. The height,
and
the
again, height that's ratio. One of those things that, you know, we've talked about this before and we got to talk about it again, and it's worthy of mention. And that's the reason it's so funny that when you see, like, say Al Capone portrayed in, you know, movies and things, he's always the short little guy. Well, in real life, he was this big, well-built, 6 foot tall. So he was six, even a 6 foot was a lot taller than most guys at the time.
Yeah.
Because the average height was still 5'6", 5'7", you know? And so, you know, when you've got a guy who's 300 pounds and 5'6", or, you know, that's
okay,
on the average side. And I don't know if he was shorter or taller than that, but he probably looked like Winnie the Pooh.
That's true.
You know? So, I mean, obviously his name was Blubber Bob. So, definitely had some heft to him.
Yes. Yes. I love some of the names of these. We've gone through some before, and even just in Grafton, there was, like, you know, the Bloody Bucket and stuff, but Bucket of Blood, Saloon. The library. I love some of these
which
things.
You know, across the street from Bedbug Row.
Yes.
It's not a place that anyone would want to go, I wouldn't think.
No.
Yeah, that's all the name. And listen, there were a lot of other nicknames. There were so many different vice districts at different times in Chicago history. And there's some funny names.
Yeah.
But like I said, I wanted to stick with the Levee because that's where Jim's restaurant was. And that's where most of his operation was.
Yeah. So he's got, I guess, that cafe is and his restaurant. So that's like his home base, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. It was his headquarters, but it was also sort of his... you know, the thing he was most proud of, you know, it was a way for him to, you know, really show off and be the magnanimous, you know, slap you on the back kind of guy that he knew was good for business.
Uh-huh.
And people would come there and, you know, the celebrities would come there, people, show business people that were performing in vaudeville. And, you know, as he mentioned, he loved opera. And so Enrico Caruso would come down. It was a lot like watching, like, say, if you watch like Casino or something and, you know, you got the guy at the doors down there slapping everybody on the back and, you know, handing out free rooms. And it was that kind of thing. You know, I'm going to put you at my best table.
Glad handing the high rollers or whatever.
Right. Exactly. And that's kind of what was happening here is, you know, there was plenty of gambling to be had at the cafe. And, you know, it was a, you know, really hot spot for several years. And people came, and part of the thrill was coming down and, you know, you're on the Levee, you know, and these are, you know, rich people from, you know, the lake shore, and they're down on the Levee and, you know, risking their lives. Not really.
Right. But
so they could go, you know, so they could hang out here at this spot. It remained the spot for a little while longer. So
I could see it too. You know, you have these not very legitimate businesses. Then you have this one where you walk in and maybe just for a minute, He gets to feel like he belongs, like he's made it. He gets to forget about the bad, you know, the kneecaps he just broke probably 20 minutes ago. He gets to come in and shake hands with some rich people and do that. And then gets to go back to reality where most of my business is terrible stuff. And so because he gets so successful, he ends up drawing the attention of, once again, the Black Hand. We get to bring back the Black Hand.
I know. I knew we talked about it before. I think those are the New Orleans season we talked about.
I believe so.
Yes. Any place where you've got a lot of Italian immigrants and New York, New Orleans, Chicago.
Yes.
And you know, it was funny because, you know, people think, well, it must be an organization. But again, as we described before, really wasn't organized. It was just criminals who were using the same method of operation.
That quote helped me understand it better.
Yeah, I think, well, and I think that people would hear about it and think, ooh, that's a good idea. I'm going to give that a shot.
Yeah.
You know? And these were, you know, pretty minor people. But, you know, if you could, you know, send this letter and make some money that way by extorting somebody, why not? When, you know, let's say they didn't pay, well, what do? You shoot up their house, you know, blow up their car or, you know, whatever. And that gets the point across. And then the next time they'll pay up.
Right.
And, you know, this was happening to any of these Italian and Sicilian immigrants who had made it good. You know, they started making a lot of money. And so people went after them. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it was their own people went after them. So there's no honor among thieves at all.
Yes.
And so they would go after them and would lean on them trying to make money. And Chicago had a really bad problem with this. And around, you know, between 1909 and say 1912 or 13, they had a lot of it. And I mentioned the shotgun man.
Yes, I made a note of that.
There was an area on the near north side known as Death Corner, which was around Oak Street, and which was today is a really ritzy area. But
yeah, I know Oak Street.
Yeah, it wasn't then. And it was known as Shotgun Corner. And there was the shotgun man or the Death Corner.
Yes.
And the shotgun man was responsible for at least 38 murders. you know, but again, nobody knows for sure if it was the same guy or not. Nobody knew who this guy was. They never caught him or anything. But anyway, it you know, Jim starts getting lined up by this. And at first he goes along with it, but then decides not to go along with it again. And handles things on his own, but I don't think that was really his forte. I don't think he liked getting his hands dirty.
So he had to call in for some backup.
Yeah. So another guy who famously didn't like getting his hands dirty,
right,
but was so good at what he did that, you know, he would use other people to, you know, apply the pressure that he needed and mm-hmm. was a logistical thinker.
The father of modern American gangsterdom,
yeah,
they
say. Yeah, and that's one of the guys who got Capone, Elmer Irie. We'll come back later, mm-hmm. much later in the series. He was one of the guys from the Treasury Department who was responsible for nailing Capone. But he, you know, really knew that it had been Torrio who'd been the real organizer.
Sure.
Capone was riding off that. And, mm-hmm. you know, recklessly riding off what Torrio set up, as we'll eventually hear.
So. Yeah, well, something I thought was interesting about the Black Hand, I didn't understand necessarily that it was a method of crime. I think even when we talked about it before, I knew that there was a little bit of difference in them compared to some organized crime group. But something that I was very surprised to hear when they came back around here is that even Big Jim was, like you said, shaken down at first. And I was like, holy shit, this must have been a real... big damn deal. And then he whacks him and then calls him John Torrio.
Right. Who then whacks the next bunch. Smoother than his uncle did.
Yes. And then the future is clear to John about where things are going, prohibition, everything. But he knows that he and Big Jim need some help. So they send for Al Capone, which is where we leave off with this episode.
Yes. He knew that Capone would be somebody that would make a good right hand because he knew how to follow orders.
There you go.
That's how Capone started. Mm-hmm. I mean, things would eventually change, obviously. But and eventually he'll end up in charge. But that's a little down the road, and we'll get there. We will get there. So,
awesome. Well, then it is now time for our Ghostwriter segment. So if you have a question or comment about the world of the macabre, you can email us at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. And this message comes to us from Cassie. And Cassie says, subject is love the podcast. Hi, I first listened to the podcast in 2019 when I binged the New Orleans season. I learned so much in preparation for my first trip to NOLA. Sadly, I put it aside for a while as I entered a true crime podcast phase. A couple of months ago, I was looking for something different to listen to, and I remembered how much I loved the NOLA season, so I came back. But this time I started at the very beginning. I'm about to start episode 41 and just want to say how much I love the podcast. And I actually listened to the very end. Not going to lie, it's hilarious when Troy interrupts Cody's outro. Okay. All right. Thanks, Cassie. Episode 41. I don't even know what.
I don't either.
Season two, three,
I don't know
probably.
What season we were on.
Probably season then. Three.
Probably but three.
Went and started at the very beginning. Imagine starting off on the NOLA season and then jumping back to season one or season two.
That'd be
rough. Glutton for punishment, Cassie.
Yeah,
but so thank you very much for writing in. We appreciate the note. I'm glad that you're enjoying it.
Yeah.
What do you got?
So we can also, people can also text us on the hotline if they have questions or comments or anything. The hotline is 217-791-7859, and it might get read on the show. I only have a couple this time, which is okay, because sometimes I have more than I can possibly read. But
right.
I do try to answer them when I can, and I am sometimes bad about doing it as often as I should, but I always try to get it in before we do another episode. But I did want to mention, I won't read the podcast or read the message. It wasn't much of a message. She just had a note about you. I think you had posted something about the upcoming Spirits in Stone podcast. And Diana said that she was thinking about doing a podcast like that in her area. So
Stories in Stone.
So, yeah, Stories in Stone. What did I say?
Oh, Spirits in Stone.
Stories in Stone.
Which we've been working on, and I'll have more information about that coming up shortly. But Diane, please, you're going to do so much better than I'm going to do.
Well, no, actually, the thing, what I was thinking actually is, it's since it's Diana, who was our former podcast
listener of the year,
but is also a frequent contributor to the show. Maybe she should still do it in her area.
And you know what? You maybe should totally
could
still
be.
Do it.
No. What I mean is maybe that could be part of what you're doing with it.
That's beautiful. That's
so maybe you guys should talk. Mm-hmm. So that's just my thought.
Okay. Sometimes I see exactly where you're going, Troy. Other times you still surprise me, man. That's why
this
works.
Just a thought. You know, it was just a thought. So, all right. This one comes to us from the 630, and it says, so I'm the dork who's listening to the live Dead of Winter recording, even though I was there live.
Nice.
We laughed about that. So it's possibly even weirder and occasionally more funny than the first time. You guys are awesome. So I thought that was funny.
Yeah, thank you.
So, and I just have one more, and this one is actually about one of our American Nightmares episodes.
Okay.
And it was a Devil in America episode. I don't know if comes to us from the 724. It says, I don't know if this gave me any peace of mind that we've seen this kind of movement before, or if they fill me with despair because we didn't learn anything the last time. That's something that I've been kind of delving into here and there with the Nightmares, American Nightmares podcast. Sometimes it's just a story. Sometimes it's some commentary and a story. And we've had a lot of episodes about history and about women and abortion and immigrants. And it's almost frightening how some of it still echoes today.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that has been it's a fun podcast for me to get to do. I get to play around with things I might not otherwise get to. And I'll soon be, as I'm getting closer and closer to my era of, growing up during the satanic panic.
Yes.
I'm very excited about covering that in ways that I've never been able to cover it before.
Nice.
So I'm not there yet, but we are getting closer.
You're getting there.
Closer.
Okay.
To that. To that time.
Ooh,
in our history.
I'm gonna have to tune in and check this out.
It's been fun. It's been a fun podcast to do, just because it's something different. It's not stuff that we're covering, and so I get to do something a little bit different with it. So it's been fun. So
awesome.
I'm happy that people are listening. Hopefully they're liking it. I really haven't. I've heard a few from a few people, but not very many. So either hate it and you skip it and don't listen, or you just, don't have anything to say. But if you have something to say, please send me a text. Troy, I will just because I don't know, honestly.
So. I want people to text you and all that, but what I will say is numbers don't lie. You're doing great. Okay. Well, numbers lie all the time, especially people like me make them lie. But no, I love it. And you ready to take us out?
Sure. Yep. That sounds good. Thanks again, guys, for checking out the story and the postmortem for this week's episode of American Hauntings, which is part of the American Hauntings Podcast Network. We hope you love this show, along with the other shows in the network. And if you do, we hope you'll tell other people about it and encourage them to listen. And if you get a chance, leave us a review wherever you listen, which makes it easier for people to find us. As a thank you to our listeners, we also have a discount you can use to get 10% off any books, tours, or events you purchase from our online store. Just use the word podcast at checkout to save. American Hauntings is more than just this podcast. It's books, tours, ghost hunts, events, the Haunted America Conference, and the American Oddities Museum in Alton. And you can find everything we offer on the website, AmericanHauntings.net.
This episode of the American Hauntings Podcast was written and narrated by Troy Taylor, and it was produced and edited by Cody Beck.
Yeah, did you see I put that in really big letters for you? So
24 type font. Yeah, I'll have to check this part of the episode too to make sure I didn't just peek or anything, but I tried to turn away from the microphone.
Actually, I didn't even hear you say it. So I thought we were all supposed to fill it in our mind.
Oh,
I never heard you say a word.
I turned and screamed that way.
I didn't hear a scream.
To find out more about the show, check out the show notes or go to our website, AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com. If you want to find out more about the podcast, you can reach us via email, by text on the hotline, or on Facebook and Instagram, where we're often hanging out. Thanks again for listening. We definitely wouldn't do it without you. So until next time, goodbye.
So long.
See you later.
See you later. Cool.
Could you really not hear me?
No, I did. Sorry.
This episode was brought to you by the American Hauntings Podcast Network.